You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt, and today my guest is Isabel Allende, who is here upon the publication of her memoir, Paula, published by HarperCollins Publishers. She's the author, of course, as well, of The House of the Spirits, of Love and Shadows, Eva Luna, The Stories of Eva Luna, and The Infinite Plan. This book is a book that's, in a way, remarkably difficult to talk about because it was written as she sat at the bedside of her daughter, Paula, who was in a coma and whose gradual death extended over a year's time. I can understand how one could write such a book out of the need to have a communication. But after you'd written it, was it bearable to reread it? How did you feel about it afterwards?
Actually, I started writing the book when Paula fell in a coma, and the first sentence of the book somehow describes the whole book. The first sentence is, "Listen, Paula, I'm going to tell you a story so that when you wake up, you will not be so lost." The whole idea was a letter for her because I was convinced that she was going to wake up. The book started to grow as this illness was prolonged. First weeks, then months passed, and I was there writing and writing about Paula and about my memories and my life. So the book was growing in a very organic way in two parallel lines. One was the development of what was happening to Paula, and the other one was the chronological order of what had happened in my life. When I finished, the ending of the book I didn't know, of course, but the ending I should have known was Paula's death. When she died, it was a very peaceful and wonderful moment, a long day and a long night, that really transformed all of us who were there. However, we couldn't find Paula's husband because he was traveling. And I didn't want him to see her wife for the last time, in a morgue or in a hospital or someplace. So I wanted him to see her at home. And by the time he got there, a day and a half had passed. And I stayed during all that time with Paula's body, holding her. And I think that by the time he came, I was like in shock. So I remained in a sort of state of shock for a couple of weeks. And my mother came up with this wonderful idea. She said, "You know what? No vacations, no therapy, no pills, nothing will help you. Because the pain is like a tunnel. And you go through it, and just believe me, at the other end there is light. You can't see it now, trust me, there is. And your way of walking through this tunnel is writing. There's no other way for you. Other people can do it in other ways. You can't." And so she practically forced me to start writing. She thought I was going to write a novel or something. But the only thing that I could write was rewrite the book that was already written. It took me a year in which every day I went through the same motions I had gone the year that Paula was sick, only that now I knew the ending. I knew that the only outcome was death. And I somehow reconciled with it. I accepted it. And I found peace in the writing. And great joy in the writing, too. I cried a lot, of course. Every day I cried. But I also laughed a lot. And I when I finished it, I felt that there was so much to celebrate. So much joy, so much friendship, so much love to celebrate. Then the problem was that this was a very intimate book, not meant to be published. No one thought it would be published. But after the family read it, we all decided that it was time to publish it, maybe. What happened then was that, of course, my mother and everybody else said, "Well, here we are with our names, with our stories. We don't want to be there exposed, do you?" I didn't mind very much to be exposed. And when I really tried to cut some things, to change names, I just couldn't. I thought I was betraying the whole spirit of the book. And finally, the family accepted to be there with their names and their stories and no censorship.
One of the very interesting things about reading this book is that as one reads, one becomes aware of the rituals of writing that writing has always had for you, that you begin books on a particular day in January because your first book was begun on that day, The House of the Spirits, that writing and storytelling itself comes from a very hidden and private place, from the box of books that were in the basement that belonged to your father that you read in secret, and then later your stepfather's hidden erotic collection of the Arabian Nights, which were kept, the collection of the Arabian Nights, in a sealed suitcase.
Closet, yeah.
Yeah. That had to be jimmied open. And so there is the sense, very amazing, that all of the ghost stories and stories of the Arabian Nights, and also you mentioned that you translated melodramas into Spanish from English, are entering here into this book, Paola, and at the center there is a Sleeping Beauty. And just every time, as I was about to say, no, Isabel, your grandmother isn't living as a ghost behind the drapes, I would think, well, of course she must be in a sense, because if someone can be silent in a coma for a year, so can every other spiritual thing happen as well. It's as if this event is not only a death, but a validation of the imagination. Do you know what
and
I mean?
And a validation of the spirit.
Yes.
You know, I have written several books of fiction. And since the very first book, I have been confronted by critics and sometimes by professors about this thing that they call magic realism, as if it was a literary device invented by Latin American writers to lure European readers into this exotic thing that somehow is called magic realism. And I've always said that I don't feel, at least in my case, that it's a trick. It's a way of seeing reality in its multiple dimensions, accepting as part of everyday life dreams, obsessions, passions, premonitions, coincidences, the incredible synchronicity of certain events, how cycles sometimes close perfectly, imagination, instinct. My grandmother, who was a very intuitive person, used to say that the air was full of presences of all times. If we could just open our minds, we could feel all times present here. During that year of Paola's illness, I was in so much stress and anxiety and pain that I think that I entered into a sort of hallucinating state in which often I had the feeling that what had happened at night during a dream was more revealing or important than anything that happened during the day. I had a dream when Paola fell sick that she was dying, and I did not believe it. I denied the dream. And I had exactly the same dream the night she died, with a different ending, but it was the same circumstance, the same dream. So why should I deny in my life the importance of all these things? Why should I not use them as part of my literature, but also my life?
Mm-hmm.
The fact that I dream my grandchildren before they are born, and I dream the sex and the name and the face, why wouldn't I use that? It makes my life so much richer.
In the course of Paola, you describe one of your brothers who went out in quest of a false messiah, someone who turned out, in fact, to own a grocery.
Yeah.
And you've spoken as well, when you were a journalist, of the kinds of people that you would interview, prophets of different sorts. Does it become important to distinguish the false from the true spiritual voice?
I think so. When in the last months of Paola's illness, when Western medicine gave up on her, I looked for psychics, for shamans, magicians of all sorts, and I was very disappointed. However, I was never disappointed with something inside myself, mm-hmm. that was like an inner voice, an inner search that is very private and is not in any way commercial. It has no external rituals. I was never disappointed by that. Although I'm not a religious person and I don't believe in the God that I was taught when I was a child, I don't belong to any traditional religion and I feel very uncomfortable with male gods, I found something sacred inside myself in the room where Paula was, in my relationship with her in the moment of her death.
You know, it's funny. When I first moved to California, I had what might be considered...
From where are you?
I'm from New York.
Oh, my gosh. What a change.
I had what many would be considered to be a quintessential Californian experience. I came to work in a metaphysical bookstore. And I remember that I would stand behind the desk, and all of these ways of thinking were at the time very new to me. And there would be clients, and they would have a pile of books on meditation with candles or crystal therapy or life after life and reincarnation. And then they'd point out some book on, say, telekinesis or astral projection and say, well, that's nonsense, isn't it? And I would always try and figure out how they made the distinction between what could be believed and what had to be rejected. Many things in your book you describe, yes, she is imagining a pyramid around Paula. Okay, pyramid therapy, crystal therapy. What are the gradations, I guess, of hope?
I think that you start with great disbelief. And as you grow more and more desperate, then you cling to anything. I remember that I asked somebody to bring some holy water from a place in Mexico. And I was totally convinced that if I could pray hard enough and give this water to my daughter, she would wake up. When she had severe brain damage, she didn't have a brain. And I thought she would wake up because of this holy water. So there's a point when you also give up on everything and you say, okay, no, the real miracle is to let go. The real miracle is to accept and accept not only the fact that she's dying, but learn from this thing and learn what death has to tell us, that it is not the opposite of life. It's the complement, the continuation. You know, I'm so fortunate that in the same room where Paula died, my granddaughter was born. Mm-hmm. And both moments are so similar. They are made of the same fabric. And it happened in such a short time that I could see the similarities in such an obvious way that I can't deny them anymore. When Andrea was born, my first question, the question that popped out of me as I was taking her out of her mother, was, tell me where you come from before you forget. Because I had the clear vision of her coming from a place and through a door that was her mother. And when Paula was leaving, also the same question. Tell me, what do you see on the other side? Because I also had the clear feeling that this was a threshold. Where do you trace the line between what is BS and what is an insight or a vision? I don't know.
It's a very interesting question because, you know, fiction, on the one hand, compels our willing belief, or at least I, as a reader, have always been very happy to believe anything.
Yeah.
The more unbelievable, the better. On the other hand, in life, as one has friends suffering from AIDS or other incurable diseases, it becomes quite a matter of emotional life and death that people not make up stories for you, cures that don't exist, treatments that are more harmful than the disease or harmful more quickly than the disease, so that the question of the war between faith and reality, or as exactly what you're dealing with here, the war between fiction and memoir, seems to be what one wants to happen and what one has to face does happen.
I also had this superstitious idea that as long as I kept writing, she wouldn't die. that writing would keep her alive when prayer wouldn't. On the other hand, a person in my situation is very vulnerable. We got a lot of mail from all kinds of psychics and all kinds of people promising all kinds of cures. And I did crazy things until I found out that my son was sorting the mail. He would come home early to sort the mail and get rid of most of it. And he was censoring my mail. And then I realized that I was crazy, that I was doing crazy things. And it was obvious to everybody except to me.
You know, what you say, that writing, the belief that writing would keep her alive, that does strike me as being at the very wellsprings of narrative, because after all, for Scheherazade, queen mother of your fiction, writing, storytelling at any rate, keeps her alive from night to night. It's her knowledge that there is another story the next night that will keep her from the sword of Shayar.
Yeah.
and so I think for any writer, there is a belief that writing is a life source, is a sustaining source.
Not the writing per se, but the keeping alive the memory, mm-hmm. the storytelling. Because it's not my memory that I want to preserve, it's other people's memories. The memory of what has never happened, the memory of what may happen, the memory of other people that I will never meet and never confront my story with their story to see if it's true, but something inside me tells me that I'm telling their story. So that storytelling is like a source of life.
I'm speaking with Isabel Allende, the author most recently of Paola, published by HarperCollins. Sometimes in the midst of incredible outflows of sympathy, one feels rage. Let me alone. I'm furious. I don't want any of your compassion. I want to feel alone, and in fact, I want to revile and reject you. The book is so loving, almost continuously so, that I wanted to ask you about rage.
I've been asked if I don't feel very angry at the doctors whose arrogance and ignorance produced severe brain damage in my daughter, or angry at the hospital that neglected her, or angry at God for causing her to die at 28, or angry at her father for passing her the gene of porphyria, or angry at whoever. I don't feel anger. I'm not a fatalist in the real sense of the word, because I think that we can influence our destiny, but I do believe in destiny. I think we are given the cards, and sometimes the cards are marked. In Paula's case, they were. She had a time bomb in her metabolism. What can you do? Everything happened, all these misfortunes happened together, and this thing happened to her. I could not protect her in any way. I could not control the circumstances. I could not predict anything of what happened. So I do not feel anger, really. I feel a certain sadness. I don't feel the anger that why did it happen to me? Because it happens to most women all over the world. For millennia, they have been losing their children. It's only a number of privileged women in urban areas, industrialized countries, among educated classes who have access to medical care, who can say, all my children will live. Because most mothers know that some of their children will not.
To write such a book, or at least to publish it, one would have to have belief that literature can be a consolation, not just to yourself, but to others. I notice, for instance, as an epigraph from a very beautiful Robert Bly poem, an early poem by Robert Bly, but did you find consolation in literature?
Yes. I did not read a lot during that year, but I wrote a lot. And in the writing, I found great consolation. First of all, just the craft of writing requires a lot of concentration and time. The days were very long for me. There was nothing to do but wait and hope. First, sitting in the corridor in close to intensive care in Madrid, I couldn't be in the waiting room because everybody was smoking. So sitting there in the corridor, the hours were so long. And while I was writing, they I could cope with that because I was entertained. I was remembering. And then later, during the year of mourning after Paula died, also 8 hours a day of writing helped me go through the day just for the simple reason that I was busy doing something. So that helped me a lot. And then as I kept on writing, I could see all of a sudden the patterns of my life, the person I am, synchronicities. Somehow things became clear in a weird way. And now I face my present and my future with less confusion because I can see my past and I can see that I tend to repeat certain things. That now that I more or less know the pattern, I know more or less where my life is going. And that is comforting.
I'm curious, you said that at that time, and understandably, you couldn't read. When you began to read again, were there any particular books that you found helpful?
I can't read self-help books.
No, I didn't mean that.
And I can't read psychological manuals. I can't read books about death. I can't read manuals about Buddhism. It's just impossible. I get very distracted. But I read fiction.
Yes.
I read fiction written by women mainly, by minorities. With great greed, I read them because I find there those connections, the relationships, the stories about families, the stories about love and about the great passions of motherhood, sex, of all the things that for me are so important and have driven my life. Somehow I can relate to that and feel that I'm not alone, that there's all these crazy women out there writing these crazy books that I can relate to, and it's wonderful. It's like a sisterhood of weird women.
One of my favorite parts of Paula, and because I want listeners to know that this is not just a work of sadness, but of great physical intimacy with the world, is your description of the sea urchins that the fishermen fed you, and which become part of an initiation to sexual experience, which then, you know, contains the sea and all sorts of tastes. It seems to me to be a passage of great, almost sort of Laurentian beauty. And I wondered, as you were writing this, did you feel that you wanted to save some of it for a novel?
No. And I didn't think of this as being literary in any way. This is how it happened. It happened exactly like that, and that is how I remember it. My mother, when she read it, she said, "This sounds like a metaphor for something." Mom, that's how it happened. It's no metaphor there. It doesn't symbolize anything. It's just how it happened. And I still remember the taste of the sea urchins. And when I think about it, it's always a sexual feeling.
Because you describe also the spiders.
Yes.
Can you tell about that? What?
Well, in Chile... Well, I don't know sea urchins in other places of the world, but I suppose they're more or less the same. In Chile, they're very big. Sea urchins are very big. And many of them have a little black spider, like a little crab, very small inside, that feeds on the flesh of this seafood. So it tastes like iodine, and it tastes like salt and seawater and seaweeds and crab. And many people think that this little, they call it the spider, la araña, the erizo, the spider, is the concentration of all the tastes of the sea. So it's a delicacy. And some people just put the live spider in their tongues and let it crawl inside the mouth, and then they swallow it. I tried, but the fact that it was a spider was too much.
Because what was amazing to me was several things. This book is being written for the daughter, And it is the mother telling a story of sexual initiation to the daughter. And I thought, well, you know, because I often feel this, that writing is a form of parenting anyway, mm-hmm. for me. My sense of reality has come from many father and mother writers. And so I thought about the strange miracle of offering something so sensual and so powerfully rendered to the daughter in case it had not been shared, that everything must now come out as a communication.
Well, it's in the same intention of sharing everything with her that I talk about things that we never quite talked when she was awake. Things that happened and determined her life. For example, the fact that we had to leave Chile at a certain point and go into exile. My kids were little at the time, and I didn't think it was necessary to explain anything to them. They had to follow the fate of their mother, and their mother could not live in Chile any longer. So we had to leave, and they had to say goodbye forever to their grandparents, to their bikes, to their neighborhood, to their friends, to their school, everything. And there was never a conversation about this. It just happened to them. When Paula's grandmother, we call her Granny, died, we didn't talk about it. Granny died, and Paula did not live the experience of saying goodbye to the person who had loved her the most in the world, and who had died of sorrow when she had to be separated from Paula. And we never talked about that. So it was time for me to tell her how her grandmother had died, why we had left Chile, why I am the person I am. When I tell my daughter that I had a lover and I abandoned her father to follow this lover to Spain, maybe I have to go back a little and tell her why I am the person I am, why I am so sexual that I could leave her and her brother and leave my husband and leave everything to follow a man who offered something that was so important to me. In order to explain that to a daughter, I needed to go back and tell her what my sexual initiation had been and how it was loaded with guilt and with fascination, with threat, with sin, with all the elements that make sex for a Catholic so attractive.
I've been speaking to Isabel Allende, the author most recently of Paula, published recently by HarperCollins. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse. Pop.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica.